again. This is Randall Rickman, your reader. You're listening to North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. I'm Randall Rickman, reading Time Magazine for the next hour. The date for this issue, since it's a double issue, it has a double date, and that would be March, that is March 16th and March 23rd. So we had a lot of material to get through, and so I will go right to the major section that starts the magazine called The Brief. And the subsection that opens the brief is called Opener. And the category is Health, where the headline is, As Coronavirus Spreads, So Do Questions. Though it may feel as if we've been living with COVID-19 for a lifetime, that's partly because things are moving so fast. It took about a week from when the World Health Organization, parenthetically WHO, received reports of a novel coronavirus for Chinese scientists to sequence its genetic blueprint, and just weeks more for labs to develop a test that could accurately identify it. Yet, scientists are still scrambling for basic information that will be key to designing an effective public health plan, including how fast the virus spreads and how often infections are deadly. Here's some of what we know so far. How is COVID-19 actually transmitted, and how can I protect myself? First, definitions. A coronavirus is called novel because it's new and the human body has no immunity to it. SARS-CoV-2 is the technical name of this one. COVID-19 is the disease it causes. I'll repeat that for clarity. SARS-CoV-2, and I'll spell that all caps, S-A-R-S, hyphen, capital C, lowercase o, uppercase V, hyphen 2. SARS-CoV-2 is the technical name of this one. COVID-19 is the disease it causes. The virus is spread by coughs or sneezes, which release virus-containing respiratory droplets into the air, where they could be inhaled by others or land on mouths or noses if people happen to be within a distance of about 6 feet. It may seem like a face mask would be the best guard against this kind of spread, but the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, parenthetically CDC, doesn't currently recommend them for healthy people, except on a doctor's advice, largely because there's not enough evidence that masks actually stop SARS-CoV-2 from infecting people wearing them. Parenthetically, the CDC does recommend masks for those who are sick to stop droplets from getting out in the first place. Then there's the issue of coming into contact with those droplets wherever they happen to land. For healthy people, that means the most important prevention is frequent hand washing, preferably using soap and water. Experts have recently backed away from encouraging alcohol-based hand sanitizers as they can contribute to the rise of antibiotic resistance. And there's no major reason to opt for a fist bump instead of a handshake, or to avoid such greetings, as an infected person would have to sneeze or cough into his hand and touch someone else's hand, and that second person would then have to place that hand in close contact with his nose, mouth, or eyes. Long story short, the best thing you can do to keep yourself from catching the virus is to wash your hands regularly and avoid touching your face. That particular segment was written by Alice Park. The article continues. Question: should I stock up on cleaning products? Answer: many people are racing to stockpile disinfectants and sanitizers, to the extent that major retailers are concerned about shortages. A representative from the Clorox company also confirmed to Time that it has, quote, increased production of our disinfecting products, unquote. These products have not been specifically tested against the virus that causes COVID-19, since it is new, but experts are optimistic, quote, standard cleaning products that will kill other viruses will be presumptively fine, unquote, says Dr. Aaron Glatt, chief of infectious diseases at Mount Sinai, South Nassau, in New York. But Dr. Rick Martinello, medical director for infection prevention at the Yale New Haven Health System, says you don't need to go overboard. Quote, I wouldn't recommend anything beyond routine cleaning in a typical household, unquote, he says. The exception, of course, is if someone in your house is diagnosed with or suspected of having COVID-19. In that case, Martinello says, try to designate a bathroom for their use and routinely wipe down surfaces they touch. This segment was written by Jamie Ducharme. Moving on to the next segment. The question is, who's most at risk? Answer, maybe not kids. A late February study in the Journal of the American Medical Association showed that children under 10 accounted for just 2% of all COVID-19 cases, while adults in the 30 to 79 age range groups represented a whopping 87%. The WHO found something similar in China, specifically, and older people who get the illness are more likely to suffer a severe or fatal case. In this sense, COVID-19 behaves a lot like seasonal flu. 70% to 85% of all U.S. flu deaths and 50% to 70% of flu-related hospitalizations occur among people in the 65-plus age group, according to the CDC. It's possible that because of some quirk of biology, children are less susceptible than adults to COVID-19 infection. Their cells may be less hospitable to the virus, making it more difficult for it to replicate and spread in this population, says Dr. Mark Denison, a pediatric infectious disease specialist at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. That said, authors of a New England Journal of Medicine article published in January note that children may just be showing milder symptoms than adults, making them less likely to seek medical care when they get the virus, and thus less likely to be counted. In any case, it seems that at least right now, kids are at relatively low risk. This segment was written by J.D. and Jeffrey Kluger, Jamie Ducharme, who is J.D., and Jeffrey Kluger. We're moving on to the next segment, which is right here, beginning again with a question. So if seniors are at risk, what should they do? Answer, not only are older adults likely to have weaker immune systems, but they also have a higher likelihood of exposure to pathogens in general, especially in residential senior facilities. In the event of coronavirus infection in such a facility, seniors should avoid communal rooms and even group meals, says Dr. Stephen Gambert, director of geriatrics at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Then there are the doctor's office visits. People with multiple medical conditions typically visit multiple specialists, and every such visit means entering an environment that can be teeming with viruses and bacteria. Dr. Tina Chopra, Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Hospital Epidemiology at Wayne State University, advises older patients to postpone doctor visits that aren't essential, like ophthalmological appointments or dental cleanings. Staying current on vaccines, especially those for flu and pneumonia, can also be critical. And that again, Dr. Tina Chopra advises older patients to postpone doctor visits that aren't essential, like ophthalmological appointments or dental cleanings. Finally, it's important to remember that the way COVID-19 presents itself in a younger person is not always the way it presents itself in someone who's older. Quote, any reason you don't feel the same as you usually do should not be dismissed, unquote, Gambert says. Will my insurance cover this? For Americans, it's complicated. The federal government has been covering initial coronavirus testing, and tests will continue to be covered by Medicaid and Medicare. But as testing expands to academic and commercial labs, it's likely they'll charge other patients. America's health insurance plan, the insurance industry's main trade group, says insurers will cover any, quote, reasonable, medically necessary, unquote, costs related to COVID-19, just as they would for other medical conditions. That means if you have a plan, the coronavirus test and other care will likely be covered. However, patients will still face all the regular complications of the U.S. health care system, including surprise bills, restrictions on doctors, and high deductibles. That last point is particularly key at this time of year. If patients haven't yet spent down their deductibles, which for most people reset each January, they'll have to pay more out of pocket. New York said it would require some insurance companies to waive costs for testing, and lawmakers and experts are urging more action. While the insurance trade group is, quote, monitoring the situation, unquote, it has not recommended that insurers change their policies to help people access COVID-19 care. So for now, coronavirus is covered or not, similar to other health needs. This particular question was covered by Abigail Adams. We move on to the next question, which is, should I cancel my upcoming travel? Answer, with more than 92,000 cases reported in dozens of countries, health and government agencies around the globe have issued warnings about international travel. In the U.S., for example, the CDC recommends people avoid non-essential travel to China, Iran, South Korea, and Italy. Several airlines have already suspended or reduced service to virus hotspots. David Abramson, a professor at New York University's School of Global Public Health, says he thinks people should avoid traveling in the coming weeks and months, especially if they feel unwell or aren't required to go anywhere. Quote, "This is a pretty volatile time," unquote, he says. Quote, "And by the time you travel, it may look different. You can't anticipate where the cases are going to appear," unquote. Still, the WHO has said that curbing travel and trade is generally, quote, ineffective, unquote, in stopping the spread of disease. According to a notice from the organization, travel restrictions can, quote, interrupt needed aid and technical support, unquote, and cause disruptions to affected countries' economy. Those traveling domestically are advised to follow guidelines already in place to ward off the virus. At home or on the road, stay away from those who appear to be sick. Don't touch your face, and make sure to wash your hands. This question was written up by Mahita Gajanana. The segment here begins with another question. Is a vaccine coming soon? Answer. Not for at least a year. In the last week of February, Moderna Therapeutics, a biotech company based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, shipped the first vials of its COVID-19 vaccine to the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, parenthetically NIAID, part of the National Institutes of Health, parenthetically NIH. Moderna Therapeutics shipped the first vials of vaccine to NIH in Bethesda, Maryland. NIAID is now readying the vaccine for human testing as early as April. Moderna's vaccine against COVID-19 was developed in record time, just 42 days after the genetic sequence of SARS-CoV-2 was released by Chinese researchers in mid-January. Nearly as important in the fight against COVID-19 are antivirals, drugs that can be administered to those infected in order to limit the virus's ability to reproduce and spread to others. In late February, NIH scientists also began testing an antiviral drug called remdesivir that had been developed for Ebola. I will go back and spell remdesivir. It is spelled R-E-M-D-E-S-I-V-I-R, remdesivir, an antiviral drug that had been developed for Ebola. Volunteers will be randomly assigned to receive either the drug or a placebo intravenously for 10 days as doctors track the amount of virus in their bodies. If the drug shows some efficacy in keeping blood levels of SARS-CoV-2 from growing, it could help contain the spread of the infection. Question. Will warm weather help? Answer. President Donald Trump has floated the idea that coronavirus might soon be nothing to worry about, saying at a February 10th rally that, quote, "In theory, when it gets a little warmer, it miraculously goes away," unquote. Indonesian officials have also suggested a warm climate will protect their country. But experts warn not to count on summer as a solution. There are several seasons flu and cold tend to decline in the summer. Several reasons, I'll correct that. There are several reasons flu and cold tend to decline in the summer. Humid weather can make it hard for respiratory droplets to spread viruses, and people spend less time in close contact indoors. But those changes may not do the trick with COVID-19. We already know some other deadly members of the coronavirus family don't seem to be seasonal, says Thomas Bolicki, director of the Global Health Program at the Council of Foreign Affairs. Even if summer helps in the Northern Hemisphere, the Global South could then get hit, and COVID-19 could come back north when the weather changes again. Quote, policymakers and health officials should not rely on warmer temperatures to save us from COVID-19, unquote, says Bolicki. Quote, the only things that can do that are public health preparedness and level-headed policies. This question was written up by Amy Gunla for Time. And that is the question and answer segment in its entirety. On the facing page, the headline is, The Time for Containment is Over. Article by Alice Park. Before we get into the text of the article itself, it is accompanied by three metrics that stand out. First metric, the number 78. Caption explains, number of countries and territories with confirmed cases of COVID-19, 78. Next item, the number, 92,844. Caption explains, number of documented cases of the coronavirus infection globally. Again, 92,844. Last metric, 3,160. Caption explains, global count of deaths due to COVID-19 infection. Again, 3,160. Alice Park writes, there comes a point in the unfolding of every epidemic when public health officials acknowledge that despite their best efforts, an invisible microbial foe has managed to outwit them. That time has come. As cases of COVID-19 began to wane in early March in China, there was a surge in new infections around the globe, from Iran to Italy, South Korea to the U.S. Deaths also rose. The U.S. recorded its first coronavirus-related mortalities, and health officials warned the disease has, quote, pandemic potential, unquote. There are now more than 80,000 cases of COVID-19 infection in mainland China and nearly 13,000 outside the country, with the latter tally growing daily. When the Chinese government took the unprecedented step of quarantining first the city of Wuhan, where COVID-19 emerged, and then 60 million people living in the province of Hubei, where Wuhan is located, the hope was to contain the virus. If the people most likely to have been exposed to and infected by the virus couldn't travel, then they couldn't spread the disease very far. That was also President Donald Trump's public reasoning for the aggressive travel restrictions the U.S. government put in place in January, denying entry to many foreign nationals from China, and funneling passengers arriving in the U.S. who might have traveled to China through select airports where they had their temperatures scanned, and then, for those with a fever, on to further testing and monitoring. But if COVID-19 has taught government and public health leaders anything, it's that containment, in an era when viruses are given wings through the ease of international travel, is increasingly only a short-term strategy for combating infectious disease. And that's especially true when it comes to the COVID-19 virus, which appears to jump covertly from person to person by piggybacking in some hosts without really making them sick. Detecting these people is akin to capturing clouds and public health officials are acknowledging that the time for containment has slipped through their fingers. But that reality is proving more difficult for political leaders to accept. At his first press conference directly addressing the COVID-19 outbreak, Trump downplayed its potential impact in the U.S., declaring that a widespread uptick is, quote, not inevitable. The risk to the American people remains very low, unquote. Chancellor Angela Merkel reassured the German public on her website that, quote, the German health system is well prepared, unquote. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe of Japan, along with the International Olympic Committee, maintains that the Summer Games will continue as planned in that country. But critics say the health ministry has held back on testing for the disease out of fear that it would expose an alarming number of infections. Betting too heavily on containments succeeding almost certainly slowed preparations for dealing with the virus's spread, including scaling up testing and medical facility capacity to accommodate a possible surge in patients. Quote, the cat is out of the bag. COVID-19 cannot be contained, and we know this is going to be a pandemic, unquote, says Dr. Tom Frieden, former director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, and president and CEO of Resolve to Save Lives. What's making the shift from containment to control especially difficult is COVID-19's unknowns, its contagiousness, incubation period, and deadliness. Quote, it could be like an average flu year, or way worse, or not as bad. We just don't know, unquote, says Frieden. U.S. health officials anticipate that in order to minimize transmission of the disease, some communities will need to adopt policies like advising employees to work from home and canceling public gatherings. That's just a glimpse of what might be coming, not just for Americans, but for people worldwide, warn the residents of Wuhan. Quote, there are so many things you can't see with your eyes, like the emotional damage people suffer from, especially the survivors who have lost family members to this outbreak, unquote, says Togo, a resident who anonymously volunteers online to connect COVID-19 patients with treatment. Quote, but this is only on the outside. The way they were hurt, the scars they have, will never recover. Unquote. That was the entire article by Alice Park, Time Notes, with reporting by Charlie Campbell, Dateline, Beijing. And we move ahead, and still in the brief, we are now at the milestones page. Lead item under died. Jack Welch, business leader, observance by Alejandro de la Garza, who writes, when he took the reins of American industrial behemoth General Electric in 1981, Jack Welch, who died March 1st at 84, launched a new era at the manufacturer. He cut divisions making small household appliances, which was stymied by competition from Asia, drastically expanded GE's finance business, and shed thousands of jobs, quote, for productivity reasons, unquote. During his tenure, revenue nearly quintupled, and Welch retired in 2001 with a record $417 million exit package and a reputation as one of the most revered executives of the 20th century. GE has since fallen on harder times, and so has Welch's legacy. The 2008 crisis made the finance arm a liability, and he has been denounced by critics for outsourcing manufacturing to China. Welch's management style has fallen out of favor among executives, and executives have fallen out of favor with the public. But Welch was not one for looking backward. Among his precepts was this one, quote, "If we wait for the perfect answer, the world will pass us by," unquote. Entire observance by Alejandro de la Garza, Jack Welch. This item is accompanied by a half-length color candid photograph of Jack Welch. No, it's actually a portrait rather than a candid. He is in a shirt with a tie, but no jacket, making it look like a candid photograph. Underdyed, James Lipton, maestro of the master class. Observance by Ellen Burstyn. Time says Burstyn is an actor and a current co-president of the Actors Studio. She writes, "When James Lipton, who died March 2nd at 93, first came to the writer-director's unit at the Actors Studio, I knew who he was from his 1968 book, An Exaltation of Larks. What I didn't know was that he was not only a writer, but also an actor and a producer and a director. I was very impressed with all his accomplishments in so many different areas." This was soon after the death in 1982 of Lee Strasberg, who was head of the studio, and we had to take over the responsibility of keeping the Actors Studio going. We invited Jim to be on the board, and he suggested the idea that we develop a master's degree program so we'd have a workshop for professional actors, but also a school that trains the new generation. Jim became the dean of the school, and then we designed a master class where members of the studio, like Al Pacino and Paul Newman, would come in and be interviewed by Jim for the students. Then Jim said, quote, "You know, we really should tape this," unquote, and that became Inside the Actors Studio. I've never known anybody who did so many things in so many different directions so well. I was most shocked when he turned out to be an expert horseman, and he was very amusing with a great sense of humor, so he was quite a spectacular person to know and to work with all these years. We are all going to miss him desperately. Ellen Burstyn on James Lipton. This item is accompanied by a half-length color photo. Caption says, "Lipton guest starring as himself on an episode of Glee in 2012. Above, Lipton won an Emmy in 2013 for Inside the Actors Studio. Underdyed. Pioneering physicist and technologist Freeman Dyson died on February 28th at 96. Underdyed. Joe Colomb, founder of grocery chain Trader Joe's, died on February 28th at 89. Underopened. The Vatican archives of Pope Pius XII, who reigned from 1939 to 1958, opened on March 2nd. He has been accused of turning a blind eye to the Holocaust. Undernominated. Representative John Ratcliffe to become Director of National Intelligence, President Trump said, on February 28th. In 2019, Ratcliffe withdrew an earlier bid for the job. Underdeclined. Colombia's Constitutional Court to rule on a high-profile abortion case on March 2nd, leaving the country's restrictive abortion laws in effect. Underruled. The Trump administration immigration official Ken Cuccinelli's appointment was unlawful, ruled by a federal court on March 1st. Under awarded, the 2020 Pritzker Prize to Dublin-based architects Yvonne Farrell and Shelley McNamara, awarded on March 3rd. They are the first two women to share the award. Under inserted, misleading language about the science behind climate change into at least nine U.S. Interior Department reports inserted by an agency official, according to a New York Times report published March 2nd. And that is the entire content of the Milestones page. On the facing page, the section is the bulletin, still in the brief. Under news, the headline here for the bulletin is, after Delhi violence, Muslims in India fear what's next. Article by Billy Perigo, Dateline London, and Samer Yasser, Dateline Delhi. They write, surrounded by smoldering houses and burned cars in northeast New Delhi, Muhammad Ifaz said he would never return to India's capital. Quote, we will never come back here to live among Hindus, unquote, Ifaz told Time as he loaded his small truck, preparing to flee to his home village after riots in Delhi left at least 47 people, mostly Muslims, dead in late February. Quote, the divide between Hindus and Muslims is unbridgeable now, unquote. And your reader corrects his mistake. That's on me. The correct location is northeast New Delhi. The writers now list three areas that they cover. First area, mean streets. Beginning February 23rd and lasting several days, the riots were a bloody milestone after 6 years of Hindu nationalist rule. Since winning re-election with a huge majority in May, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party, parenthetically BJP, has pushed policies that critics say put Muslims at risk, including a controversial citizenship law in December that sparked months of protests. The Delhi riots began after a local Hindu nationalist politician called for Muslim protesters to be cleared from the streets, but many observers said the febrile climate made violence inevitable. Second item, mob rule. Some Hindus were also killed, but it quickly emerged that Modi's BJP and the Delhi police, his government overseas, had quietly supported the mobs targeting Muslims. Rioters chanted slogans, burned buildings, and beat Muslims as police reportedly looked on. Quote, they have tacit permission and probably also protection, unquote, says Thomas Blom Hansen, a scholar of Hindu nationalism at Stanford University. Modi condemned the violence 3 days after it began, but experts say that while the BJP claimed non-involvement, its rhetoric and policies were responsible. Last and third item, burned bridges. Muslims, who make up some 15% of India's population, to Hindus 79%, fear not only more violence, but also continued government persecution. Before driving away with his wife and son, Ifaz had no doubt who was to blame. Quote, the BJP has won in its battle to paint all Muslims as traitors, unquote, he said. Quote, this is what the Hindu nationalists wanted, unquote. complete article by Billy Perigo in London and Sahir Yasir in Delhi. Sharing this page is a sidebar feature news ticker. Three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item. Migrant deaths after Turkey opens border. A child died after a boat carrying 48 people capsized off the Greek island of Lesbos on March 2nd. It was the first reported death since Turkey announced it was opening its borders with Europe to migrants on February 29th, resulting in a huge increase in people attempting to get from there to Greece. Second item in the middle. U.S. seeks new fees from immigrants. Under a proposed Executive Office for Immigration Review regulation released February 27th, it could cost immigrants nearly $1,000 to fight deportation in court, nearly 10 times the previous amount. The rule would also charge asylum seekers a $50 court fee, with waiver applications available for those who can't pay. Last item. Netanyahu tops Israel's election. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu claimed victory over centrist rival Benny Gantz in Israel's general election on March 2nd, the country's third in less than a year. Results suggested Netanyahu's conservative Likud party failed to win an outright majority, but he called it a, quote, victory against all odds, unquote. Moving ahead, we move now to the next major section, The View. The subsection is World, where the headline is, Give Peace a Chance, article by James Stavridis. As we take the first major halting steps toward a peace agreement in Afghanistan, all I can remember is how we got there in the first place. On 9/11, I was a newly promoted one-star admiral working on the Navy staff in the Pentagon. My office was in the new section of the building, and I literally watched the airplane hit the Pentagon. As I stumbled out of the burning building onto the grassy field below, the irony of the moment struck me. Here I was, in the safest building on Earth, guarded by the strongest military in history, in the capital of the richest country in the world. If the Pentagon wasn't safe, what was? We pause here to read the brief bio note. Time says James Stavridis was the 16th Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. We go back now to his article. We all knew everything would change, especially for those of us in the U.S. military. I was wrenched out of my comfortable assignment as a strategic budget officer and selected to lead Deep Blue, a hastily created think tank charged with charting a new course for the Navy in what would become known as the War on Terror. We didn't really know what that meant, nor did we appreciate all that would unfold in so many places around the world, and how many would die as a result of our retaliation. But we did know that the plot that killed 3,000 Americans had begun in Afghanistan, and very quickly the focus of the U.S. military became going there, finding al-Qaeda, and destroying them. The Taliban, who had harbored them, were at the time a small obstacle that we quickly overcame. As tens of thousands of U.S. troops deployed to a strange, foreboding nation whose geography seemed to resemble the surface of the moon, we could never have predicted we were embarking on the longest war in U.S. history. Over nearly two decades, hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops rotated through Afghanistan, generally on one-year assignments. At the conflict's peak in 2013, over 150,000 U.S. and allied troops from over 50 nations were deployed there. Many became casualties, including nearly 2,500 killed and over 20,000 wounded. During my 4 years commanding the NATO mission Enduring Freedom, I wrote 1,700 letters of condolence to grieving families, about a third of them Europeans. It was a hard time for the U.S. military, which was caught in a classic counterinsurgency battle against an implacable, determined foe. Progress was hard to define, and the frequent changes of command at every level in the country hampered our efforts. We suffered from Taliban safe havens across the border in Pakistan, difficult supply chains, and a tendency to emphasize positive developments while understating the challenges. Despite the frustrations and the casualties, we were able in time to turn the fight over to the marginally capable Afghan security forces and to withdraw the vast majority of our troops. We have brought home 90% of our troops, with only 13,000 or so still there. Hopefully, the peace agreement will be successfully concluded and will hold, thanks to Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad's timeless efforts. The tenuous next steps will be negotiations between the Afghan government of Ashraf Ghani and the Taliban. The objective, from the U.S. perspective, will be to bring home more of our troops, although ideally we would retain a cadre of around 5,000 special forces and trainers to help preserve the gains of democracy, human rights, and gender equality that have been so painfully achieved. We've seen this movie before, of course, in Vietnam. There it ended terribly, with all our forces withdrawn, funding cut to the Vietnamese army, and helicopters lifting off the rooftop of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. Many of our local allies of decades were tortured and killed in, quote, re-education, unquote, camps. It doesn't have to end that way again, but success will require a modicum of funding for the Afghan security forces. Maintaining a conditions-based approach before withdrawing more troops. Real dialogue between the Afghan government and the Taliban. Continuing rights for women. And engaging our allies in keeping up support for the Afghans. It will be hard to make this peace. I'd estimate the chances of a successful outcome, defeat, defined as the Taliban actually accepting a long-lasting peace, at roughly 50-50. I'll repeat that for clarity without the extra phrase. I'd estimate the chances of a successful outcome at roughly 50-50. But we need to recognize that there is no military solution here. We have spent much blood and treasure on this honorable cause, and it would be foolish to throw it away. Entire article by James Stavridis. We go forward, and still in the section called The View, the subsection is the recurring The Risk Report, where the headline is, The Coronavirus's Blow to Globalization by Ian Bremmer. As Americans try to decide whether they're too worried about coronavirus or not worried enough, fears of recession have shifted Washington into action. Congress appears poised to approve billions of dollars in emergency funding. On March 3rd, the Federal Reserve chipped in with an emergency interest rate cut of half a percentage point, the biggest such cut since the 2008 financial crisis. The Fed's hope is to limit economic damage inflicted by the virus by boosting business confidence and household spending. But the effect is to remind us that already historically low rates leave the Fed with limited ammunition. It's just one more source of anxiety about the virus. In reality, it is those who live in parts of the world whose health systems are less developed that have greatest cause for concern, for both their personal health and the resilience of their economies. The first week of March saw the first confirmed coronavirus case in sub-Saharan Africa. Chinese workers were allowed to return to jobs in Africa after the Chinese New Year holiday, making further spread of the virus in Africa likely. In any pandemic, the worst-case scenario involves its spread into developing world cities where huge numbers of people live, healthcare facilities are poor, and millions lack the money to afford whatever care is available. There are also larger emerging market countries that will take a huge economic hit as a result of lost tourism. But the impact of canceled travel would be much greater in Saudi Arabia, where the kingdom's first confirmed coronavirus case has closed Islam's holiest shrine to foreigners. If Saudi authorities are forced to cancel the Hajj, the annual pilgrimage of millions of Muslims to visit these sites, scheduled to begin in July, the impact would be dramatic. Other countries that depend on tourism revenue, particularly in Southeast Asia and Latin America, will face tough losses. Even in the U.S., where this crisis has only begun to make an impact, the response may fall far short. There are some shortages of crucial drugs and medical equipment, in part because China remains a critical part of supply chains. Another worry, coronavirus has been swallowed into election year politics. President Trump, anxious to protect the stock market gains that he believes will boost his chances of re-election, has argued that Democrats are exaggerating the coronavirus threat. Critics of the president warn that Trump will lean heavily on the Fed for more cuts, less for the sake of U.S. economic resilience than for the president's political fortunes. In coming years, the coronavirus outbreak may be remembered as a milestone moment on the road toward the end of the first phase of globalization. Over the past few decades, markets have opened, supply chains have gone global, middle classes have emerged, and new connections have been made. More recently, a backlash against the increasingly free flow of information, ideas, money, jobs, and people has created extraordinary political pressures. The result has been tightened immigration rules, new barriers to trade and investment, a shortening supply chain, a technological decoupling, and a new emphasis on country-first politics. Coronavirus has already forced travel restrictions, accusations between governments, and a series of xenophobic attacks in multiple countries. Depending on the level of human and economic damage this virus inflicts around the world, coronavirus may one day be considered an important turning point for the entire global economy. That was an entire article by Ian Bremmer. And moving forward, we join the cover story, which is 100 Women of the Year. This article is Margaret Thatcher, written by Billy Perigo. Margaret Thatcher, Iron Lady, 1982. The decades after the Second World War were a chastening time for the UK. The once mighty British Empire lost most of its colonies, and despite steadily rising living standards, the British economy was no longer the global steam engine it had once been. So in 1982, when Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher led a successful military campaign to defend one of the last of Britain's overseas outposts, the Falkland Islands, from an Argentine attack, it stirred a swell of patriotism, reigniting the wartime spirit, especially for her Conservative Party's elderly voters. The following year, those voters rewarded Thatcher with a massive parliamentary majority, which she used to unleash a free market revolution. She slashed the size of the British state, deregulated the economy, sold off dozens of state-owned industries, and cut taxes with the proceeds. Many became rich as a result of her reforms, but inequality increased substantially, too. The rift she created in British society still cuts deep. But nobody disputes her position as one of Britain's most influential prime ministers in the 20th century. Moving ahead, we have an observation on Corazon Aquino, 1986. Observance by Carl Vick. There was a mythic quality to Corazon Aquino's ascent. Well-born and a devout Catholic, she was a supportive wife to the Philippines' most prominent critic of kleptomaniac dictator Ferdinand Marcos, and seemingly harbored no political ambitions until her husband's murder in 1983. She took over as leader of the opposition and won the presidency in 1986 after ordinary people gathered to protect soldiers who refused to stuff ballot boxes. Time named her Woman of the Year. Philippines went with, quote, Mother of Democracy, unquote. That democracy has endured on the archipelago. So have its power structures. A tradition of elite rule helped her son, Benigno Aquino III, to a widely admired